Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and at the other end of the line, down a very snowy road, is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Yes, and I hope it's warmer wherever anybody is listening.
Well, we're sitting here with 20 inches of snow on the ground.
Oh, my God.
And temperatures today are a balmy 20. But tomorrow it's, I think the high is zero or something like that. So Fahrenheit, we're talking Fahrenheit here. So very different weather than the setting of our book today. Well, today we're talking with Veera Hiranandani, and she is the author of A Meal and the After, which is a follow-up to her Newbery Honor winning The Night Diary. She earned her MFA in creative writing at Sarah Lawrence College and is also the author of The Whole Story of Half a Girl, which was a Sydney Taylor Notable Book and a South Asia Book Award finalist, and How to Find What You're Not Looking For, winner of the Sydney Taylor Book Award and the New York Historical Society Children's History Book Prize. Veera is a former editor at Simon & Schuster and now teaches in Writing for Children and Young Adults MFA program at the Vermont College of Fine Arts. And welcome to Writers' Voices. I think we've spoken with you before, so I think it's welcome back to Writers' Voices, Veera.
Yes, thank you so much for having me again. I do remember our talk years ago about The Night Diary, so I'm so excited to be back.
So let's just start out with what these two books, what is the historical setting for these two books and why you wanted to write about it for young adults?
Sure. So The Night Diary is set right before the 1947 partition of India, and it focuses on a family who is living in Mir Prakash, what is now Pakistan. It's the Sindh area of Pakistan, but before partition, it was all India. And so The Night Diary focuses on a young girl's diary, fictional diary that she's writing, talking about how they had to leave their home during that time. And so when the partition happened, it happened in 1947 at midnight between August 14th and August 15th. And it happened at the exact same moment that India became independent from British rule. And this was supposed to be a very triumphant time for India, but there was a lot of tension between the two largest groups, religious groups in India, Muslims and Hindus. And there was a lot of concern about everybody being represented equally in the new government. And then when the British left, you know, the lines were drawn very quickly, and the British sort of drew lines kind of right through people's communities, and it created a lot of conflict very quickly. And so about 7 million people had to leave their homes. About 7 million Muslims had to leave their homes and go over into Pakistan for safety. And about 7 million Hindus and non-Muslims had to travel in the other direction over the new border of India. And so my father grew up in Mir Prakash, just like Nisha in the book. And he and my grandparents and my aunts and uncles also had to leave their home during that time. So A Meal in the After is a companion book. So it follows the same characters and sort of takes place a few months after they have to leave their home. And now they've traveled to Bombay, India, now called Mumbai. And it's really about how they rebuild their lives, but it's from a different perspective. It's from Nisha's twin brother, Emil's perspective. And so it's looking at that.
And since Emil's not a writer like his sister and doesn't keep a diary, instead he records his thoughts and feelings in pictures.
Yes. That was really exciting for me to kind of think about how that would work. So in The Night Diary, he drew a lot, but I had a chance in A Meal in the After. Now it's from his perspective. Nisha suggests to him, because he's really, you know, he feels very lonely and displaced, and they've gone from They went first to Jodhpur and then to Bombay. So they're kind of starting all over again. And this was because their father had a new job that he had to follow. So Emil just has a lot of questions about the world and is trying to make sense of it. And Nisha suggests that he start a drawing journal for their mother, who is no longer living. She died during childbirth. And so Nisha, just as Nisha wrote this diary, now Emil is writing this drawing in his drawing journal, sort of these drawings for his mother, kind of processing what he's going through and expressing his feelings and just having this creative outlet. And so I had the idea of what the drawings would be about or look like, but we needed a professional to help us with that. So the illustrator Prashant Miranda is the person who did the drawings. And I met Prashant before the book. And when we were thinking about who could do it, I had seen some of his work, and it just, he does a lot of these kind of sketches and watercolors on his own Instagram. And he just has a sensibility that I thought would be really perfect for the book, for the illustrations.
They are wonderful. I was reading a digital copy of the book. And so but I think the paper copy would be even better, you know, the physical copy. So
yeah.
Caroline, did you enjoy the pictures, the illustrations?
Yes, I did. I really did. It added a great deal to the book.
Yeah. So whose idea was it to split India into two, into a Muslim and a Hindu nation?
Yeah, that's a complicated question. I don't know if I can answer it fully, because I'm still sort of kind of figuring it out even after two books and all the research. But essentially, there were I would say maybe four major players sort of in the political landscape. So there was the new prime minister of Pakistan, Jinnah, and the new prime minister of India, Nehru, and then, of course, Gandhi, who more people in the U.S. maybe are familiar with his work. He was someone who felt like he didn't want to see the partition happen, so he was really a force to try to prevent it. But it was about, you know, are people going to be represented equally in the government? And then, of course, the British wanted to kind of wash their hands of India quickly and just leave, and not really sort of kind of take responsibility of what might have been left. And so they were the ones that really created the lines that were drawn. And so where my father is in Sindh, that was a community that didn't have lines drawn kind of like right in the middle. So like more northern areas like Punjab, that there, you know, like something like the area of Lahore, lines were really drawn right through communities and caused an enormous amount of conflict. Because once people are divided that way, then they're on other sides and they're facing each other as sort of pitted against each other. But the area of Sindh, where my father is from and where Nisha and Emil's family is from, there wasn't a lot of conflict. There was actually a lot of respect and for the different religious groups that were there, and things were peaceful. But then once these lines were drawn, the mistrust and the violence started to grow, and it started to kind of move into other areas that didn't have as much conflict to begin with. And so that's really what happened to my father's family. And so he's part of a group of Hindus who are Sindhi, because they're from this area of Sindh, and they pretty much all left. There are some Hindus that are still in Pakistan, but most Hindus left that area and kind of went all over the world, not just over the new border. And so the group is sort of thought of as they don't really have a homeland anymore. And so that is part of what I wanted to explore in this book. But I think most people feel like the British were the ones that drew the lines, because they just couldn't figure, not the British, but everybody couldn't really figure out, you know, how to stop the fighting. And then maybe like, well, if everybody has their own space, then it'll be okay. But as we see over and over and over,
yeah,
fighting people based on race or religious identity does not work very well. And it didn't work very well then. And there's still a lot of tension between Pakistan and India.
So. Now, you say there are still some Hindus in Pakistan. Are there still Muslims in India as well?
Yes, very much so. So, you know, India in the beginning, right after partition, there was a lot of migration, forced migration. But now India probably has more Muslims than numbers-wise than in Pakistan. So it's very different from what the beginning was, you know, right after the partition.
But and they're able to get along.
India. What?
And the Hindus and Muslims in India are able to get along.
Sometimes.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. And again, I feel like I'm not the person to kind of speak in that like larger sense of like Muslim and Hindu relations in India, because I am by no means an expert. I really have focused on my research, you know, right around the partition and right based on my own father's family's experiences. But there are continued tensions. But, you know, for a number of reasons that I don't want to get into, because I don't think I'm really prepared to talk about it. But yeah, so that's what the landscape is now. But right after the partition, there was a lot of separation between the groups.
Now, Emil and Nisha, with their father's family being Hindu, and their mother's family being Muslim.
Right.
Is that a similar, was your father's family divided that way too?
Right. No, actually not. So my father's family is all Hindu.
Okay.
Part of the reason that I did that was because my mother is Jewish. So I'm from an interfaith family, certainly not in the same context as Emil and Nisha's family are in, but I understand what it feels like to have two religious identities in your family and try to figure out what that means for you. So that's part of why I did that. And the other reason I did that was because I wanted Emil and Nisha to ask this question: if they are connected to both of these identities, both Hindu and Muslim identities, and then their country is being split apart along these lines, but they have deep emotional connections to people and the identity, the people that inhabit these identities, you know, what does that mean? And they're really trying to figure it out with that kind of sort of honest, frank, child-like innocence of, you know, well, why are we fighting? What's happening?
Yeah.
Why are we supposed to kind of not
take a side? How do we take a side?
How do we take a side? And my, you know, my father is Hindu, my mother is Muslim. What does that mean for me? And so I really wanted to kind of elevate and focus on that interfaith identity, especially when there's so much effort to kind of divide people along those lines.
And in the book, there are some family members who are Muslim, who are living with them in Bombay and have to pretend to be Hindu. Was that people really do that?
Yes. During my research, especially right after the partition, sometimes people would have to hide their identities if they couldn't leave or didn't want to leave, in both Pakistan and India. So there are many accounts of people doing that, or sometimes people would convert to one religion or another. That tended to be more on like patriarchal lines, you know, if women converting to whatever their husband was. Sometimes there were even forced conversions. A lot of things happened. But what you're referring to in Emil and the After is So they are now in Bombay with their father, who is a doctor, and their grandmother. But then they also, their family cook, who has become like a family member, but he is not related to them. Qazi, he is Muslim, and they leave him in the night diary. And I don't want to spoil things, but I guess if you're reading A Meal in the After, you know that he found them. He travels and risks his life to go over the border because it's his family now. And so when they first get to Bombay, he sort of hides his identity as he is kind of, you know, going to the market in Bombay. And he's called more of his Hindu name, Qazi, when they're out and about in public just to keep him safe. And so then that theme kind of goes throughout the book. I don't want to tell spoilers, but about like hidden identities and people having to keep themselves safe that way.
Right, right. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Veera Hiranandani, who is the author of A Meal and the After. And what age group in particular is this book aimed at?
Well, it's considered middle grade. Okay. So YA in general is kind of split into middle grade and then more teen YA.
Right.
Fiction. So, you know, ages 9 to 12 is usually, or 8 to 12 is usually the window for this book. I would say 9 to 12. But I also say my books are for ages 9 to 99.
I think so.
To be read by everyone. And I sometimes hear generations reading it, you know, where maybe the grandparent is a partition survivor, and it's a difficult topic to talk about. And then there's the, you know, the kid of the grandparent who's my age and not a child at all. And then their children, kind of reading it all together as three generations as a vehicle to talk about this topic, which is, it's a hard one to discuss sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, you said, I'm quoting you in the book, you said, "I believe we all carry the resilience, joy, and pain of our ancestors. Writing historical fiction based on my family background is a way for me to understand something that's part of me, even though I never experienced directly." And I think that's great. I don't ever remember studying this in school.
Mm-hmm.
This whole thing, and I can't believe that. I mean, I just because
I mean,
it was
you would have important. Been a teenager when this was happening.
Yes.
Yeah.
I know. So
and
I
you
have
weren't
been studying it,
and you weren't aware of it even happening.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in Connecticut in the 70s and 80s, and I only heard about it. I mean, maybe there was a line in my history book that said, you know, Pakistan was created and India became independent, but there was no explanation for what happened. So I almost thought that the story of my father's family having to leave their homes and finding a new place in Jodhpur and then eventually Bombay, now called Mumbai, it was just something that I didn't fully understand that happened to my father's family. I didn't understand that this was something that impacted millions of people. But then I saw the movie Gandhi came out when I was 11. And I remember going to see that with my family. And it was really one of the first times that I understood. I was kind of shocked that this was what my father had been referring to, because they show a lot about what happened during the partition. I mean, in maybe a bigger Hollywood depiction of that. But there is, you know, based on my research, there's a lot of truth in what happened. But I was really shocked that this was what my father had been talking about and that I was connected to this piece of history. So that kind of stuck with me. And I didn't know I'd grow up to be a writer, but when I did, I felt like it was important to try to understand it for myself and think about what my father went through and my grandparents went through and what would that feel like and be like, because it's somehow just, you know, as I said, we do kind of pass on these things to our children. And so I think it's really important to understand kind of, if we know that information, you know, where we come from and how we are here today. Kind of what happened to Brandon. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how much history I've learned from historical fiction. So yes. I really count on historical fiction writers to do the research and get it right, because yeah, I'm going to believe them.
Yeah, that's very true. And it's a daunting task, because I do think that people, I certainly do, I understand history a lot better if I'm reading a fictional account of it, because I need that kind of emotional attachment to the story.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, when I was learning history and it was just a bunch of names and dates, I really had a hard time kind of keeping it straight or remembering it or having it resonate with me in any kind of real or emotional way. So, you know, I never thought that I'd write historical fiction. I wasn't even that great a history student growing up. But I think that a book like this would have helped me. And I really focus my research on, you know, I'm not an academic. I teach creative writing, but I'm really in the world of writing stories and creative fiction and nonfiction, not so much in the academic realm. So my research is very much based on certainly the bigger brushstrokes of what was happening historically, but then really getting into what families experienced, what individuals experienced, going in both directions, and what it was like in a really personal way. And so I've listened to a lot of oral histories about people having to leave their homes, both from Muslims and Hindus and Sikhs, which is the third largest religious community in India. And so that's how I've kind of put together the story.
Wow. So you said you weren't really all that interested in history initially. What really triggered it for you to want to write historical fiction?
Well, my first book, The Whole Story of Half a Girl, was very much based on my own experiences growing up in Connecticut. When I switched schools, I went to a very small private school. It was kind of this art-based school that some of my parents' friends were involved in kind of creating, this kind of like co-op school. There were about 50 kids in the entire school, and so we all knew each other so well. And then when I had to leave, because there wasn't enough enrollment actually for a fifth grade. And so that's when I went to my town's public school, and it was, you know, hundreds of kids, and just, it felt like I had landed on a different planet. Mm. And suddenly my background became a thing, and people started, nobody could kind of say my last name. Every teacher and every roll call would always say it wrong. And say it right, you know, like it was just kind of skipped over in that way. And people would ask me how I could have two religions in my family and what did that even mean. And there weren't, you know, I don't remember, there were a few other Jewish kids. So my mother's Jewish and my father is Hindu. And I remember maybe two kids with South Asian backgrounds in the entire school and a handful of Jewish kids, and then nobody like me. So I didn't kind of realize before that how different I was. And so I wrote a book based on some of those feelings. But in that book, you know, I was thinking about the fictional parents in the book, just made me think about my own parents' history more somehow in writing that book, even though the characters are fictionalized and a lot of things happen in that book that didn't actually happen to me in real life. But I started to think and go back in time, and the partition really was something I was always curious about. So I was really intimidated by the task of writing about it. And it took me years to kind of just think about it, write notes, talk more to my father and other family members, and get my head around it of kind of what lens I wanted to put on it. And then I just went for it and wrote The Night Diary. And then about a year after The Night Diary, and it did well.
Yep.
And it was a successful attempt, which was amazing to me. And then about a year after I wrote The Night Diary, I really missed the characters and I wanted to come back to them and revisit the world. But I didn't want to write like a direct sequel. I didn't want to necessarily continue it exactly the way it was. I wanted to try to do something a little different. So I wanted to focus on Emile. A lot of the students that I would visit at school visits wanted a book from his perspective. So I wrote this sort of companion novel where it does follow the story a few months after, but it gives a very different, it has a very different feeling and a very different point of view. And it's really looking at, you know, what happens after the survival story, right? Because The Night Diary is more of a survival story. Are they going to survive this horrible situation or not? And then they do, but as we know from either our own personal difficulties or going through a global pandemic, you know, if you're okay after the immediate crisis of it, okay isn't always okay. There's things to process. You have to kind of put your life back together after that kind of trauma or disruption. And so that's what Emile and the After is looking at. It's looking at Emile and his family trying to rebuild their lives on kind of with this very unsteady feeling. And so that's what I want. That's the story I wanted to tell with this new book.
Wow. And you wrote another historical fiction novel, which was How to Find What You're Looking For. What time period and setting is that?
How to Find What You're Not Looking For.
Oh, How to Find What You're Not Looking For. Okay.
interesting title.
It's even longer than that. So it is a mouthful. But yes, How to Find What You're Not Looking For. I wrote in between The Night Diary and Emile in the After. And that was based on some of the things that my parents went through in the 60s when they decided to get married. And so it's not really their story exactly. There's certainly some pieces of it that I took for the book with their permission. but it's told from a young person's point of view, a young Jewish girl growing up in Connecticut in 1967, and her older sister, who's 18, falls in love with an Indian college student, and they want to kind of run off and get married. And so Arielle, the main character, is watching her parents kind of take in this information and deal with what's happening, and they are not happy about it. And part of the reason that they're not happy about it is because their Jewish daughter wants to marry an Indian man. And they, because of kind of their history and what they've been through, they feel like it's sort of their duty to have their daughter marry somebody Jewish. And so when my mother got married to my father, at first her parents, my grandparents, were not in favor of the marriage. And my father's Hindu family, his parents had died already. So his parents died younger, before I was born, not years after the partition. But they were, my father's older brothers and sister were not excited about his choice either. They wanted him to marry somebody who was Hindu. So I was kind of trying to incorporate a story around some of those issues in the late 60s, during the civil rights movement, right after the Loving versus Virginia ruling, which was the Supreme Court ruling that banned all laws against interracial marriage. And so I always thought, you know, my parents got married in 1968 in Connecticut, where it was legal for them to get married. It's kind of weird to even say that. But I always think, well, what if they were in Virginia in 1967, before the Loving versus Virginia ruling? You know, what decisions would they have made? Would they have gotten married? Would they have left the state? And so those were the things that interracial couples were thinking about in the 60s, not that long ago. So I wanted to kind of incorporate some of those themes in the story, but it's really about this 12-year-old girl who's kind of trying to deal with her own issues at school, and then her sister runs off, and her sister was somebody who was really in her corner, and now she feels lost without her, and she's not sure why her parents have an issue with what she's doing, and she's sort of angry at them, but then she understands some of what they've been through as Jews in their community, and they've been subject to anti-Semitism and some difficult things on their end. So it's really just looking at all of the levels that, you know, human beings operate on, and the questions of kind of different areas of prejudice and othering other people. And I always think about my parents. You know, they did get married. They are celebrating. They just celebrated their 55th wedding anniversary. My Jewish grandparents eventually evolved and adored my father. And I grew up in a very kind of united family with both sides of my family. So everybody, which is good.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Veera Hiranandani, and she's the author of A Meal and the After for Middle Readers. Veera, would you like to read a little bit from the book for us?
Sure. I would love to. So I'm going to read a part from the second chapter, and because we've been talking about religious identity. A Meal and Nisha, their father is Hindu, their grandmother is Hindu, Kazi, who lives with them, is Muslim. Their father is pretty secular, but Kazi and Dadi, their grandmother, are not. And Emil is a pretty philosophical kid, and he's just trying to figure out in this landscape that he's in, like, what does it mean to practice in different ways, or to not be religious, or to have a relationship with your faith? And he's just asking a lot of questions. But these questions aren't necessarily questions that the grown-ups around him or even his sister Nisha really want him to be asking. So I'm just reading a little bit at a time where they're having dinner, and Emil is kind of asking these difficult questions and kind of making his family a little uncomfortable while he's asking these questions. So here we go. At dinner that night, he stared at his mound of alu gobi and rice and at the palak paratha stacked up on a plate in front of him. He wrinkled his nose. He liked plain or alu paratha the best. The palak made it too green and depressing, like moldy bread. Pollock is spinach. Nisha, he doesn't like his greens. Nisha had seen his face when she put down the paratha. "Don't be so picky," she said in a low voice. She had no tolerance for him not liking certain foods. "Eat," Papa said, and pointed to the paratha. "We're blessed to have this food." Emil took a deep breath and put half a paratha on the side of his plate. Then he mixed the rice and alu gobi together and stuffed a pinch into his mouth. Papa stared at him, then eyed the paratha, so he used a little corner of it to scoop up more of the curry. "Papa, I have a question," Emil finally said to distract his father. Papa paused his own eating and leaned back in his chair. Emil knew Papa was tired from the hospital and didn't usually like to talk much at dinner. The silence, though, made Emil want to climb out of his skin. "Yes," Papa said. "What is it?" Emil cleared his throat. "I was just wondering who we're blessed by," he said. Papa waited a few seconds, and Emil shifted in his chair. "Who we're blessed by?" Papa asked. "Yes," Emil said, deciding to continue because anything was better than the silence. "I was thinking about how Dadi prays one way and Kazi prays another way, and you don't pray. At least I don't see you pray. So who do you think we're blessed by?" Dadi made a small sucking noise with her teeth, softly shaking her head. Nisha raised her eyebrows at him. That was Nisha's signal for him to stop talking. He knew she hated when he asked questions like this, questions she thought were too personal or would irritate Papa or make him go into some sort of lecture. There was so much Emil needed to understand, though, especially now. "You know how I feel about these things," Papa said after a few seconds. Emil wasn't sure. I forget. Tell me again. Nisha kicked Emil under the table. He ignored her and kept his eyes on Papa. Papa sighed and continued. We're blessed by anything watching over us. What's bad is telling anyone else who they should pray to or thinking one religion is better than the other. That's what gets us into a whole lot of trouble. Back in Mirprakash, people seemed okay with different ways of praying. We went to a Sikh temple, Emil said. Yes, Papa said. Many Sindhi Hindus pray with the Sikhs. Some Hindus went to Sufi shrines too. Our community had Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs, Christians, Parsis, Jains, all going about their business. There was even the Jewish synagogue in Karachi. I have no perfect answer, Emil. Just be an honest member of society. That's the most important thing, not prayer. Dottie put her cup down heavily. Then she got up from the table and shuffled to her room. Papa called out, Ma! She kept going and disappeared behind the closed door. He glanced back at Emil, anger flashing in his eyes. Now you've upset your grandmother, Papa said. Just be quiet for once and eat your supper. Emil swallowed hard. He tried to eat, even though his stomach felt funny. What he wanted to say was that Papa had upset Dottie, not him. He looked at Nisha and Kazi for help. They kept eating, their eyes cast down at their plates. He knew Dottie wanted him and Nisha to be taught how to be more serious Hindus. She didn't like it when Papa said things like that. Emil couldn't remember a day she didn't spend time praying in front of her altar in the corner of her own room. After dinner, Kazi came up to him when Papa had left the kitchen. Do you want to know my answer? He said. Oh, Emil said, lighting up. Yes. He was surprised that Kazi wanted to talk about it. Kazi tended to keep more to himself lately. Emil wondered if it was because the outside world in Bombay made him feel unsafe and unwanted. They were supposed to call him Kavi in public, a Hindu name. Papa was probably right, that if there wasn't religion, India would have stayed whole. Yet Emil wondered if people would just have chosen something else to fight about. I agree there's no right way, said Kazi. However, practicing Islam helps me see the good in people. It's the way I respect the memory of my parents. It's something I can always count on. And that's what Dottie's Hindu practice is important to her. That's why Dottie's Hindu's practice is important to her. Different religions, same reasons. It was hard to imagine Kazi as a little boy with parents. You can count on me too, uncle, Emil said. Kazi laughed. Why do you think I risked my life to join you here? We're family now. He reached out and patted Emil's cheek like he used to. Emil nodded, relieved. When Papa retired to his room and Kazi was busy washing the dinner plates, Emil sat next to Nisha on the sofa. Why do you have to ask Papa these kinds of questions? She said. Isn't it worth the risk? Don't we always learn something? Not when Papa gets mad or Daddy gets upset, she said. I don't want to upset anyone. But I don't want to only learn about fractions and geometry and correct grammar either, he told her, feeling upset himself. I'm not going to read heaps of books like you, Nisha. Now don't you get angry, she said, wagging her finger at him. I'll help you read anything you want. Sorry, he said and sighed. He felt so tired. Before they left Mirprakash, he often thought only about how he would have the most fun. Would he play some cricket, hang out with his friends, get his hands on some sweets? Now his mind swirled with complicated questions. There wasn't enough to distract him. He wished his mama could help him understand. Somehow he believed that she would know the answers. His thoughts returned to the bicycle he had seen. A bicycle would help him get his mind off things. Other kids would admire him, ask for rides, and want to be his friend. Because if there was anything in the world he wanted more than a bike, it was a friend. He decided then, that then and there, that if he couldn't get Papa to buy him one, he'd find a way to buy one himself.
And thank you. That was Veera Hiranandani reading from Emil and the After. Caroline, do you have some questions?
Well, you've answered some of them, but I wondered, you said that Kazi had to act like a Hindu when he was outside. What did he have to do differently?
Well, he probably just would have not worn a certain kind of cap that would signal that he was Muslim. And then just, you know, be called Kavi rather than more common Muslim name, Kazi. And at one point, Emil calls him uncle, which you probably noticed, but that's really just a term of respect for an elder.
Yeah.
A little more familiar term of respect. So that, and that's not something that they used to call him because he was kind of more seen as more of a servant in the beginning of their relationship. And then over the years, and then now after the partition, he's become, you know, they've sort of joined as a family. But there are still different boundaries because that's kind of how the relationship started. So it's complex.
Yeah.
Yes.
And also, I wanted to know, why was it that Britain made a decision on where to draw the lines and how to separate this country? I don't understand that.
Mm. Well, I mean, it had to do also with what Nehru wanted and what Jinnah wanted. And, you know, when I during a lot of my research, there's the kind of reasons for power and political leaders' egos and wanting to kind of run their own country and space. It was also really, really a problem that nobody could seem how to solve, that there were more Hindus in the government at the time. So the Muslim community was really worried that they wouldn't be treated equally, which was a very real concern. And so Gandhi was saying, well, we have so many different religions in India, you know, we will figure it out. But Jinnah and Nehru weren't so sure about that. And so that's kind of how the idea of Pakistan came to be. But then the British were really the ones who were kind of pushing things on a fast timeline, where this was something that was complicated and nuanced and needed time to be figured out. And because the British were, you know, it was before they were leaving, they drew these not well thought out lines through communities, and also split Pakistan. Originally was West Pakistan and East Pakistan with India in the middle. So that added to the chaos as well.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, wow.
East Pakistan eventually became Bangladesh, which is another story in itself. So, you know,
oh gosh.
I always think about what India would have been like if it never was partitioned. And I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, I guess we never will, but
no,
it would be interesting.
Yeah.
Now, in this book, you talk a lot about food.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you grow up with Indian food?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So, yeah, I mean, one thing that my family did was make a lot of traditional Indian foods and traditional Jewish foods. And then, of course, you know, I grew up in Connecticut and have hamburgers and french fries and pizza and all the things that, you know, people have. But that was also just my comfort spaces, because I sometimes felt different from my Indian cousins or my Jewish cousins who had two Indian parents or two Jewish parents. And they kind of did things and traditions that my own family didn't always do. But I knew the food, you know, in both sides of my family, from all of the cooking that we did in my house and then the celebrations I had with both sides of my family. So food, I think, is really important to me and is a way for me to connect clearly and solidly with both of the identities in my cultural identities in my family. And I also just really love reading about food. I love when other writers write about food in just really specific ways, whether it's kind of to learn about a cultural background or just the sensory experience of reading about food. You know, when a character in a book says, like, I had lunch, I was like, well, what did you have? Like, no matter how simple it was. So that's something I just enjoy doing with my writing.
Well, it's funny because when I travel, wherever I go, a lot of the focus is on food. It's on, you know.
Yeah, me too.
Where are we going to eat today? What are we going to try today? I had the best Indian food in London a little over a year ago. Man, was that restaurant was wonderful. You had to line up down the block to get in.
Yeah. No, I have a couple of good places around me. And so, yeah.
I noticed on your website that in addition to the books that we talked about that you've written, you also have a chapter book series.
Yes.
Do you want to tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. So my chapter book series is for younger kids. So it's not quite middle grade. It's like for more younger elementary school students, like first to third or fourth grade, depending on reading levels and preferences. But it's about a girl named Phoebe who falls in love with food, more food, food and cooking when a girl from France moves to town. And so Phoebe, you know, has her cafeteria mac and cheese and just kind of her parents aren't big cooks. And she's just used to eating pretty simple stuff, a lot of the same stuff. And her best friend, Sage, who's has an Indian and Italian background, actually. So she's tried some things at his house, but he's actually a really choosy eater. So she eats more sort of the same foods, even more than Phoebe does. And then this girl from France moves to town and she has, you know, salads with goat cheese and pastries and roast duck in her lunch and all of these things. And Phoebe, it kind of awakens this interest in Phoebe that she never knew she had. And it embarks on her own kind of food discovery cooking journey. But her friend Sage is not so sure about her new food discovery journey, because he's really not that interested in it. And he's also a little jealous because they've been best friends and she's now getting closer to Camille. So it's kind of a friendship triangle, but it's also about how Phoebe discovers her love for food and cooking.
That's wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a lot of fun writing about it and all the food I included. Made me hungry.
Now, I also understand that you teach at Vermont College. And yes. They have had a master's in fine arts in creative writing for a long time and were one of the very first, I think, to have kind of a low residency. In other words, remote learning before that was even a word, right?
Right.
And how have they navigated the fact that now everybody has these remote learning options and, you know, how have they stayed ahead of the curve on that?
Yeah. Well, they were really well set up for the switches that we had to make and the changes that we had to make during the pandemic. So I am only my second year teaching there. So I am a bit of a newbie on the faculty, but some of my friends who, you know, were on faculty all through the pandemic, the way it normally works there is you do two residencies. So people live all over. I don't live in Vermont, but people live all over, and then they come to one 10-day residency in the summer and one 10-day residency in the winter, where we do this sort of kind of writerly boot camp of just workshops and lectures and gatherings to kind of get all of that in-person stuff, almost a semester worth in this 10 days. And then after the 10-day residency, each faculty member gets, you know, 3 to 5 students that they're working with individually online for the rest of the semester. And most of that is really sending work in and writing. You know, I get work from my students and then I read it and write them very extensive letters back on suggestions for, you know, different things in revision revisions and books to read and stuff like that. So we have these very kind of intense individual relationships with our students and their work over the semester. So that didn't need to change. That was already in place. It's really, you know, and rather than a phone call, maybe years and years ago, now it's, you know, we have Zoom calls.
Right. Yeah.
Most of it is just kind of trading this work and responses back and forth. So what had to change was that the residency had to be, you know, on the cloud, as we call it, or on Zoom for the first few years of the pandemic. So that was a change that everybody was making at the time. And that was really the main change that Vermont College of Fine Arts needed to make along with everybody else.
But now they're back to in-person residencies for that?
Yes. Well, what it opened up is that, you know, now we have a very robust online residency. So you can choose.
Okay.
That's the choice before. So now you can do the whole thing remotely if you need to. Let's say you're far away, or maybe you have a full-time job or young children or something that doesn't allow you to go in person to the residency. So it kind of was able for them to test this option. And now it's in place.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Caroline, do you have more questions?
Let me see. well, don't think so. I think you've really given us a lot. Oh, I wanted to say that the glossary that you had was very helpful.
Oh,
and,
good.
That's unusual. I've never seen that before in a book, but I really appreciated that.
I'm glad. And I had one in the Night Diary. You know, writers make the decision to do one or not. I think because I was using so many words that a lot of U.S. readers, and especially kids who may not have access to just jump right on Google and look something up, that's why I wanted to include it. But like, for example, how to find what you're not looking for, I mention a handful of Yiddish words because my grandparents used to speak Yiddish a lot around us, and I cannot speak Yiddish, but I learned a lot of words along the way that my mother would use too, and expressions. So I included those in the regular conversation, but I did not include a glossary because there wasn't that many. It was just like very much a part of the way that they were kind of talking, and you could sort of figure it out in context. So kind of different decisions with different books.
So Vera, I understand that you started out in marketing.
Not quite.
Not quite? Okay.
I'm forgetting my own past.
Yeah.
1 year. After
1 year. And then you studied fiction writing, and then you became a children's book editor at Simon & Schuster. And as an editor, when you would get things, you'd like, oh, I wish I'd written that? Or, I mean, is that kind of what prompted you to want to start writing yourself?
Mm-hmm. No, I was one of those editors that were sort of there kind of undercover. I knew I always wanted to be a writer. My career A, and of course, all writers need to make a living. And I tried a number of things, but I was able to work both first as an assistant in the adult world, and I worked mostly on nonfiction and like business books and stuff. And I would walk the halls of children's writing, the children's department, and just kind of it just felt more inspiring. I had already gotten an MFA, and so I was writing my own short stories and trying to get them published and thinking about what my first novel would be. And so that is what inspired me to kind of move my writing more in the children's realm. And then I worked in the children's department. I was able to work in the area where there were a lot of media tie-ins. It was called Simon Spotlight at the time. I'm not sure if the imprint has changed the name. But so I worked with a lot of like Nickelodeon brands and all of their book lines. And so it was really fun work. But it was like I could see how publishing worked, and I saw people who were doing more kind of literary stuff for children. So I could kind of see how it all worked, but I also had this like separate world of the media tie-in world in my work. And then I would go home and start to tinker with my first middle grade novel, which became the whole story of Half a Girl. So yes, there was a part that definitely.
And was it easier for you to get published because you had those connections in the publishing world?
I don't know if it was easier for me to get published. It was easier for me to get read.
Yes.
So that really, you know, I did know people. I had a friend who was an editor who I showed the beginnings of the whole story of Half a Girl. And then as she moved up the ranks and then I left, I had my first kid and decided to take some time off and then focus on writing. And she read the first few drafts and gave me a lot of great feedback, and then ended up taking it to an acquisitions meeting, but it didn't get picked up there. But then she suggested to look at agents and get an agent. So she, you know, told me about people she knew and liked. And then eventually I did get an agent. So maybe, you know, I wouldn't have gotten that advice. I wouldn't have been read by the agent. Maybe I would have been way at the bottom of the slush pile, but I don't, if they didn't like the books, just like,
I
did get a rejection, then it wouldn't have happened. So,
yeah, I think, you know, from all the writers that we've spoken with over the many years we've been doing this, which it's like 17, I think. And that in the end, it's the quality of writing that counts. It's who you know can certainly help. And some people have a much more arduous path to getting read. But at the end of the day, it's do people want to read this or not?
Right. Absolutely. Whether you're writing, you know, what a historical fiction, more commercial fiction, if the agent and the editor sees a place for it in the marketplace, then it's strong, you know, for whatever category it's going to be in, then.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Vera, thank you so much for being with us today. We're just about out of time. And we always end with a quote. So, Caroline, do you have a quote for us today?
Yes, I do. This is from your book, actually. Is that the very last page before the acknowledgments? We may not all be the same, but we're all connected by our humanity. When we harm each other, we harm ourselves. So when we support and help each other, we make our own lives better. And I think that was a wonderful, wonderful thing that summed up the whole thing. Really did.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for having me.
And thank you for being with us. And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Bye-bye. Keep warm.
Yeah.